Hello, listeners. This is an earlier episode of our podcast series, engaging with specific novels, short stories, and poems from the Australian speculative fiction context. Unfortunately, we did have a mega backlog of podcasts, interviews, videos, and term papers, of course, to deal with, which has caused severe delays in our originally planned schedule. Regular, higher quality podcasts will start rolling out in the future, though, as soon as our archive is worked through, which is what we're doing right now. And we really hope you enjoy this podcast. Hello and welcome to this podcast episode on Neville Shoots on the Beach. Today, Lucas and I are being joined by Leonie.
Hi, everyone. It's lovely to be here today.
And Gillian.
Hi, everyone. It's lovely to be here tonight because I'm in Australia and it's at 10 p.m.
Who are going to add their perspectives on the beach. Leonie is a researcher at the University of Cologne, and she is doing research on nuclear literature, so that'll be an interesting perspective. And Gillian is not only a speculative fiction writer herself, but also has a very interesting background in that she grew up in Melbourne and lived at the same time as the baby in Neville Shute. That's basically her age, so we'll be getting a very, very interesting perspective on the beach.
Without further ado, let's get started talking about On the Beach. We are not going to give like a big summary of anything. We expect our listeners to have a rough idea or pull up a Wikipedia page and get started with their reading. But something that always strikes me as really interesting about On the Beach is when we kind of think of this apocalyptic doom and gloom situation unfolding, the end of the world as we know it. In a novel, we expect there to be a lot of movement, running away, this idea of fleeing to different places. I mean, if you've all seen disaster movies, some of them build their entire story around it. But there's a kind of lack of movement in On the Beach. So I'm wondering if anybody has kind of thoughts about that. I know, Tina, for instance, that you just did like a whole migration fleeing course. So there's some mobility there, or maybe... that would be a good place to start, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. So absolutely. I did a course on migration, movement in utopias and dystopias. And when I had my students read On the Beach, people were quite surprised at first, because as you said, it seems like there's a distinct lack of movement. In the end, though, we did find lots of different kinds of movement, and we've thought that movement, even in its absence, was quite important to On the Beach. And I think that's maybe even indicated already in the title, because when we have On the Beach, we're sort of in a liminal space. We might connect it to relaxation, to holiday, to staying put and, you know, lying on the beach. But at the same time, we have this place that is in between the sea and the land. So sort of like a liminal space.
I had a very interesting, it's a shame you can't see my face. I had a very interesting face throughout Tina's answer, because that's a very European answer. Europe has had many reasons to flee in the last few hundred years. The Americas have a lot of stories about fleeing, about panic. A lot of the catastrophe stories for America include big panic stuff. Australia is not really a panicky country. Look at what we do during the bushfires. We deal. Look at what we do during floods. We deal. And one of the reasons behind this, our colonization was colonization with all the negatives that come with colonization, but it had one giant factor that's different to everywhere else except New Zealand. We're at the other end of the world from the places most people flee from. We're the place people flee to. A lot of people here have background in dealing with difficulties. So we have a cultural tendency to say, what can we do, not where can we run to? And Neville Shute played with that, because no one I know of in Australia said, why didn't people run? We said, why are they talking about running? You know, the world's going to end. You deal with disaster by dealing with disaster. That's Australian. So it's a profound cultural reason for people staying put. They knew they couldn't do much. Mm-hmm. And so what they were doing was dealing.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, on the beach, Australia is literally also the place where people flee to, because that's one of the last places that is still going to be livable. So it does make a lot of sense. And just when you were speaking about this this cultural difference, I was thinking of one of the newer movie adaptations of On the Beach. So in that movie adaptation, it's from an American company, I do think so. And there's news pieces that are being shown throughout the filming where we see people actually rioting and fleeing further south in Australia when there's no mention of that in the novel. So I think that it's an interesting observation that might be due to the cultural difference.
No, not just that. You know that Melbourne is not just the largest southernmost city, but the only thing south of Melbourne is Tasmania. Tasmania is 9 miles south of, at the narrowest point, south. So you're fleeing to someone that's going to die maybe 2 days later. And the only other place to flee is Antarctica. And so, yes, I remember that movie and I remember laughing all the way through it, just as I laughed all the way through the Gregory Peck movie. They made the changes to suit the American market, but didn't look at the geography.
That's great to know. It's lovely to have your perspective on this, because I think our listeners as well probably won't know that if they're reading the novel and watching the movies, and they might contribute these changes to something else then.
We get wind straight from Antarctica. It's a long amount of water between us and Antarctica, but we are the first landmass, the closest big landmass to Antarctica. And Tasmania is about the same size as England. So you'd be fleeing to something about the same size as England, which is not very big. So yeah, that's why it doesn't make any sense for people to flee. Where are they going? People do leave in the novel, though, and they're going to the country because that's our happy place.
Yeah, I guess, well, there's the country, and then there's also people fleeing to the car races towards the end of the novel. And obviously there's some spoiler alerts here, I guess. I found this really interesting, especially against this background of movement, because it's like the entire infrastructure of Australia breaks down due to a lack of fuel. So there's no regular car movements anymore. Everybody has to go by cart and use their horses, etc. And there's, I guess there's still the rail lines and the trams that are sort of working because there's still electricity and coal. But you don't have cars anymore, which is, I think, the road narratives are obviously so prominent in the US, but you also have that culture around cars in Australia, especially at that time, I would assume. And Gillian, perhaps you have more to say about this.
I was thinking about the fuel. Because I've been thinking for years about why does Neville Shute make, he was an aeronautic engineer. He knew about where fuel came from. Australia has been since the 19th century one of the major fuel providers for a lot of the world. We talk about the coal, and the coal was what powered the Latrobe Valley in the 1950s and 60s. So that's the big power supply for all of Victoria. But it's not the only thing. There were other sources of fuel in there, and in the 70s, people started boiling oil from fish and chip shops to make more user-friendly oil in a more difficult society, because we had an interesting 70s. So fuel wasn't likely to have run out in the way that Shute suggested it did. What it meant, so he wasn't talking about the fuel, but the people who weren't willing to mine for it, who weren't willing to do the necessary amazing labours, because they knew the end was near. It was less about fuel than about what are people doing with their lives in this situation. And that made it really interesting that they chose one of the most fuel-rich parts of the world to end the world in, because it meant that that choice is really clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And where then the car races are actually a sort of luxury that people invest into, and a sort of obviously a diversion from the constant fear of being dead in a few days or months. But at the same time, I found this really interesting that the car races come up only to what, well, there's little parts in the story where you do, where they do talk about cars, but it becomes really prominent at the end. And it's actually where one of the characters loses their lives. Or quite a few. There's many accidents because people get reckless. So it also becomes a sort of way of people reflecting on their own lives and the sense of being alive at all. If it's going to end soon, anyways. So it becomes quite philosophical in this place as well.
And he chooses betting culture has been standard here for so long that there's one betting game. It's only permissible on my birthday. You can only play two up on the 25th of April, which is Anzac Day. So betting is a bad part of Australian culture. It's a very strong. We used to have, so in the 50s, 60s, there were 50s, don't know about 60s, there were illegal betting. There was illegal betting, SP betting. So car racing hasn't been as big a thing until recently, but racing, horse racing in particular, has been. You don't race horses at the end of the world because horses are valuable. You do race cars because it's luxury. So the sport addiction that Australia has is something that Shute plays with. So this is the equivalent of US panic apocalypses. It's what do Australians do when they panic? We bet, we race, we do sport. And it proves dangerous because there's no safe place in apocalypse. I think Shute's been really clever because even the people who know modern Australian culture don't know 50s Australian culture. So you can't know that we have this betting culture, that we have this racing culture, that sport is almost deity-like for us. And there was back then in Victoria only one type of football, and it was not the types you know. It was Australian rules, and the only close relative in Europe was Gaelic football. So there was an isolation in our football back then. The rest of the world just wasn't part of it. We didn't care. We had our football gods, that was enough, and we had cricket. And Don Bradman was our hero and probably still is. So all of this is folded into the car races. It doesn't have to be spelled out because every Australian who reads it and every person from Britain in the 50s and 60s knew Australia, they would also see it.
Yes, I think what you said about sports being a sort of almost a godly figure, like a deity, that also plays into this kind of spiritual element or philosophical element that Leonie just brought up, because the characters in the novel do seem to strive for some sort of movement. It's not movement to flee. It's not a way of escaping the apocalypse, but it's a way of staying mobile within it. And this is something that a student of mine also brought up in an oral exam, which we were very happy with, because she had this argument that all the characters, almost all the characters, are trying to look for some sort of movement. We have the car races, but we also have Moira starting a new education, and so moving forward in that sense. At the same time, we've got Dwight, who goes in search of this Morse signal, but then also at the end gets back into American water. So there's a kind of movement there, but at the same time, he's sort of stuck in the past by keeping up this pretense that his family is still alive.
Yeah,
it's
the same kind of movement
we all did in the first year of COVID with the lockdowns. Shute, it's a very brilliant observationalist. He just saw stuff and extrapolated. And I was thinking about on the beach during the lockdowns, because I was thinking we are living that kind of life, and we don't know what, we're not dying, most of us, but we don't know what will emerge at the end of it. And so, yeah, I felt very strongly that, and that reminded me of the first time I read On the Beach, which I hope you'll let me tell you about, because it's a very embarrassing story.
Well, yeah, but just to add to this, I think that what Tina brought up too is that there's different scales of thinking about movement. So you've got some metaphorical elements, you've got social, emotional effect would also be a sort of movement that you can very clearly trace throughout the novel. And then you've got space and time that sort of are intermingled. And so you've got the idea of waiting, which is obviously also a slowdown of time, but it's still inevitable. You still can't flee your fate because so the novel ends in the way that's already suggested at the beginning. But there's still that element of hope. So there's all sorts of movements intertwined and micro movements. So it's, I'm talking about scale. So it's not just about migration of one, but you do have, you've got all of these. So you've got lots of contrast in the novel, I would say. So you've got the larger movements of the submarine traveling the world, trying to find somebody who's still alive or to find out what the different signals that they're receiving, what they're about. But then you've also got the micro movements, including the garden restructurings that sort of Peter and Mary, they were trying to prepare their garden for the next year and things like that. And then the social element of trying to have a sort of progress to find a new job and to find a sense in life that are all intertwined here.
It's interesting to me when you talk about these different kinds of scales of movement, because then I think of the temporal movement that we associate with gambling that Gillian had talked about, in the sense that gambling has a fixed outcome, right? There's a payout at the end of the day. You know what's going to happen. It's a closed futurity. And usually there's a lot of hope tied to gambling, but there's an expectation that the end is going to go a certain way for most people, at least. And this certainly plays into, I think, some of these movements by kind of creating an operative system where we see it on multiple levels, the same kind of closing down with some kind of small element, perhaps, of hope, but one that perhaps is also accepted as futile in many of the cases in the text.
So my cousin Dinah, who would have been 25 when she read On the Beach for the first time, when it was first published, my cousin Dinah was a gambler. Victoria had no gambling. Well, they didn't have no gambling. Australia is a gambling country. You didn't have any pokies, any poker machines. You had to go to the border to New South Wales. So once a year, she got on a bus all the way to the New South Wales border, went gambling for a day, and she had a limit of $20 because it wasn't about the winning or the losing. It was about the moment of, to use the word everyone assigns to totter of, hesitation. It was the uncertain outcome. Now, that's not all gambling in Australia. There are heaps of people who, Lucas, behave exactly the way you say, but there are also people like my cousin Dinah. And I see a lot of the gambling and the not looking for outcomes, but looking for increased satisfaction in the moment as being very Australian of that moment. We've changed. We're not as much like that anymore. But we defined ourselves in the 60s and 70s as a second world country. In the 50s, we were still a colony. Even though we had been independent for 50 odd years, we were still a colony. We didn't get our full independence from the UK until the 80s. So we didn't see, and we still don't see ourselves as terribly important. And people who don't see themselves as terribly important do tend to put more value in the present than in outcomes, because they're not in a position to guarantee amazing outcomes. And I do suspect that's one of the, I mean, Shute could have knew the UK as much as he knew Australia. He belonged to both countries. He knew Canada because he worked there. He chose Australia. And I suspect that's one of the reasons you can get a very, my father, when he died, was doing very much what people did on the beach. He said, I only have this time. I don't know when it will end. I'm going to get value out of it. And this is why he was very happy one day when he could skip morphine, because he was reading my thesis and it put him to sleep. And that's a very Australian pleasure, sarcastic pleasure, I'm afraid, but very Australian in the little things and in the present. So there's an amount of the gambling. There's an amount of you're looking for outcomes, but there's also something that fits with the gardening, which is you can't control the future, but you can live.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me. There is this feeling of focusing on the present in on the beach, and at the same time of well, doing the best you can. You are preparing for a future that likely will never come, but you're still doing it in the moment. And if anybody still has a bingo sheet from our first course or any speculative fiction conference, Todorov is probably on it. So I'm glad that we mentioned him.
To shift us in our attention, maybe it would be good to think about some of the ways that maybe gender has impacted some of the different behaviors of the characters in the text, because I think that the role of gender is quite important, especially highlighted by some of the names that are used specifically for the main female characters of Moira and Mary, which are very evocative of this idea of there being kind of a virginal Mary, as well as kind of another form of Mary, the Mary Magdalene, the prostitute, or something like this, that has been talked about in some academic circles, but also maybe considering the men's roles too of Dwight, Peter, and Osborne, how they engage with their activities.
I can tell that Gillian wants to say something about Mary and Moira.
Everybody else say what they think about Mary first, because this is going to be interesting. Go first, because then I want to know what people think about the Mary and Moira, because Australian views are, as ever, Australian.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to start. What I thought about them is that at first glance, they seem to follow just that stereotype that Lucas brought up of the virgin and the whore, because we have Mary as this very domestic, young mother, very virtuous. Of course, she's not a virgin, but, you know, she is this young mother, this Mary kind of figure. And then we have Moira, who's a bit more, well, she's more relaxed. She's loose in that, you know, if we talk in conservative terms, but at the same time, she's not a negative character, right? She's not overly criticized for what she's doing. She does change through her relationship with Dwight, but it's not like she's super being criticized for the way she behaves. I don't know, Leonie, what are your thoughts on the two?
I found it quite interesting to see how in the novel that's sort of used to show the reader different aspects of what femaleness can look like, how women should or could behave, and how that might also change against the background of an apocalypse. Well, quite a bit of the secondary literature focuses on Neville Shute's conservative attitudes. And I think that can also apply to his work with gender in many ways. But even Moira, who sort of seems to be that deviant character in the beginning, potentially, if you want to read her like that, she is sort of being reformed by her interactions with Dwight. So actually, she actually decides to become sober, or sort of sober, towards the end of the novel, to take up a new job and to make herself useful to a society that she can't really do much anymore anyways, but she still does. And so, I must admit that I haven't really thought about as much about this tension between the two women or the differences, and more about the differences that we find between men and women as two separate categories in that novel. Because if we come back to the movement aspect, for example, as well, you have the men as the naval officers and the scientists. They can still go roaming and do the car races, but also go with the submarine and travel the world, even if it's obviously not the ideal circumstances. But the women have to stay home and wait for them to get back. Mm-hmm. And there's not much else that they can do. They only have these micro scales of movement with the sailing and the gardening. But that's just about it. They've got a much smaller circumference of where they can move. It's a much smaller area that they occupy. And occupy is certainly not the word that I would want to use here. So I guess that's my observations, but that's really off the track now. And let's let it somewhere else. But Gillian, I would really love to hear what you think about the women.
That's actually spot on. So Neville Shute was not being theoretical about end of world. He was depicting Australian misogyny in the 1950s. He himself was misogynist in that way. We still have misogynist society. Australian women earn 26% less than men. We are behind the eight ball in terms of women's rights. We have equal marriage. We don't have equality. There's a bunch of things which we've improved on in the last 50, 60 years, and a bunch of things we haven't. So let's start with that. It wasn't because of the alcohol that Moira was a problem. It was because she was alcoholic in the 50s, in the 60s, and even in some of the 70s, in a whole bunch of places, women were not allowed into bars. So she was breaking social norms by putting the drinking above social conventions and not worrying about it. I don't remember if she went into bars in the novel or whether she stayed in the women's lounge and got other people to get her the drinks. I don't remember. But the fact that she was capable, her personality was capable of saying, I don't care, this is the end of the world, I'm getting a drink. So she was made to be more normative and she was made to be better behaved. But she was I'm going to use bad language and there'll be an explanation for it in a second. She was the damned whore because she broke social conventions for women. Mary was the God's police, damned whore and God's police in a second, because she was the conscious virtue, though. Everything was Church of England, not Catholic. Being Catholic in the 50s in Australia was difficult. Lots of Catholics were 40% Irish ancestry at that point, but Catholics only achieved equality after that. Catholic schools, there's a really good play, I don't remember when it was written, Once a Catholic. It was called Once a Catholic. And it goes into what the schoolgirl experience was like. So Catholics were largely segregated. They had their own things, and that includes some really interesting political stuff dominated from New South Wales. But this was Victoria. And it was So there's a Catholic school system there. There are Catholics there. But Shoot wasn't depicting the Catholic anger and discrimination against and stuff. He was depicting majority culture. I can't see any references to my, I can't remember any references to minority cultures. Not mine, not the Catholics, not the occasional Greek Orthodox, not Indigenous Australians. Everybody was, and the default in Australia until the 80s was that if you didn't declare a religion, you weren't atheist, you were Church of England. This is part of a profound part of our culture. The Lord's Prayer is still used to start Parliament every session federally. We are a Church of England country. Our head of state is also the head of the Church of England, which means, so the damned whores and God's police is actually a phrase that was used for 19th century Australia. And Anne Summers used it as the title of the critical book on the subject. There were two types of Australian women in the public perception, one was in colonial times. One was the damned whore who was a convict. One was the God's police who was making everybody virtuous forever and ever. And there was no in between, and that they were cultural stereotypes. Therefore, I knew they were cultural stereotypes. And I always think that Neville Shute included one from each category, but modernized because it's still such a part. It's much less the 70s helped us get over that, because the minute everybody sleeps with everybody, the God's police don't play a part. So we had a nice relaxed 70s and we had an infusion of people from all over the world, and we learnt to behave a bit better towards women. But late 50s, a lot of people were still doing the damned whore or God's police. They were still doing those roles. And I find it a misogynist country. So I find it really interesting that Shute had one from each category to show how they reacted to the apocalypse. And he didn't have any complex women doing interesting things. So my mother got her first teaching job in 1956. And before that, she worked with cartography. But there's no women like that in the book. So there were women doing university. We've had our first university graduate woman was a doctor called Bella Guerin, 1883. So women in Australia are really strong, but we have these major stereotype and cultural constructs we have to fight. And I think she drew on them. Now you know why I was waiting for the end, because everything you both said really mattered. But they were a European view of a book rather than the lived thing. Australia's the other end of the world. People haven't noticed us for so long that all these things can happen and people don't know that they're part of our history.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that Moira and Mary then fall into these two categories that you explained. But at the same time, and maybe this is just the modern reading, like the modern perspective reading. But on the one hand, I think Moira is really one of the most sympathetic characters that we find in the novel. We really empathize with her. It's like, yes, of course you want a drink. It's the end of the world. Yes, of course you're despairing. You don't want to do anything anymore. And when she does start progressing, start educating herself, yes, in the novel it's this conservative idea of the white knight male coming in, making her better. But at the same time, it's something relatable. It's, as you said, Gillian, it's something that people also did during the lockdowns. They were learning new things, even though it didn't matter, but it was something to do. It was something good to work towards. And so in that way, I think Moira is a really sympathetic character. And what I also find interesting is that while they are juxtaposed, Moira and Mary, they're not really juxtaposed on a narrative level. They're friends, right? Moira is the friend of Peter and Mary. And there's never any indication that they don't like her. They worry about her because of her alcoholism, but it's not like they're criticizing her. They are friends. And that was very clear to me in the novel.
So that's also Australian. We have a cafe in Canberra named Tilly's after Tilly Devine. Tilly Devine was a major criminal. And she was very much one of the damned whores. And we loved her. And we still do. And we name a cafe after her. Australia doesn't make those boundaries. We're much more interested in what a person's like, how interesting they are, than whether or not they're a perfect Christian, which really annoys a lot of religious people.
Right.
Are there any other kind of main thoughts on the role of gender? Because otherwise we can kind of switch towards kind of a thread that I see that maybe parallels the COVID pandemic a bit, which is the way that like people respond to scientific discourse, but also truthfulness and things like that. Are there any other kind of last words on the role of gender first?
I absolutely think that we're going in your direction with the pandemic, but also scientific discourse in terms of climate change. But I do have some last words to say on the topic of gender, because we have only spoken about the women so far, and people tend to forget that men also have a gender. Like, this is something that I've noticed time and time again when people, men usually are invited to like a gender discussion. So, I don't have anything to say about it. It's like, well, yeah, you do. So it's not just about women. So maybe we can talk about Dwight, Peter and Osborne a little bit, because I think there's also interesting things going on there. Leonie also already went into that direction when talking about the different scales of movement, that the men are still able to do stuff, to go into the submarine and travel to North America and try to figure out what's going on. And Osborne can do the car racing, and Peter is also more mobile than Mary. So I agree with all of that. At the same time, Dwight is a very loving husband. He thinks about his wife and children constantly. He tries to get toys for his children. That is, of course, part of his denial of what's going on. But it also shows him as really very much a domestic family man when he's not on his submarine. And Peter's kind of the same. He's also very involved in his family life and trying to provide for them. Of course, the male is the provider. Again, we're falling into the stereotypical there. But I think there's an interesting dichotomy of both in these two figures. What do you think, Gillian and Leonie?
I think of Dwight as the American. And I did when I first saw that. That hasn't changed. And so to extent, I think Shute is using him to explain American apocalypse narratives, because a lot of his tendencies are tethered by the Australians around him. And if he didn't have the Australians around him, he would have done a whole bunch of stuff with no outcome. And as it was, he worked out emotional ways around it. And to me, the toy was that. It was such a big deal because it meant that he could keep his emotional stuff alive. I don't think he was really in denial. I think it was his garden. It was his way of keeping going to the end. But I do think that there's a distinct cultural differentiation between the men. And one of my disappointments with the first film was Ava Gardner is brilliant and wonderful, but did not make a good Moira because she was American. And so you missed the whole rebellion against Australian norms and pubs and things. But Dwight, you keep him under control and suddenly you can see what Australians are doing. It gives you a contrast because the Australian men are very understated until towards the end. And it could become boring very easily if you didn't have something to contrast.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned Peter and Dwight, but I think John Osborne, he's actually a professor, I think, at the university. And I think it's also interesting to see how the different jobs that they have sort of make part of their character too. So yeah, John Osborne seems to be quite different in terms of his attitudes. He's very early accepting his fate, and that determines all of his actions and also his cynicism. So he definitely has a different tone. Well, he sets a different tone for that novel compared to the other two. It seems quite elegiac sometimes, I think, very reflective and but sort of evasive too on the part of Peter and Dwight. But he's much more straightforward in many ways. So that's sort of sometimes even a comic relief, I would say. So he definitely serves a different function in that novel. And it's interesting to see how that's related to his role as a scientist as well.
Now, that's a perfect lead over to talking about the scientific discourse, right? Because he's the novel stand-in for that. And as you said, Leonie, he accepts what's going on because he knows. He's done the research. He knows this is going to happen. And there are people, alternative scientists, who say, oh, well, maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe it's just going to stop. And he's right from the beginning saying that, no, this is not going to stop. This is how it ends. And I know that this is how it ends.
So what do we make of that, I guess, in relation to the COVID pandemic, where there has been you know, a similar level of discourse, or climate change, if you prefer, as an example that also disproportionately affects Australia, maybe highlight some specific Australian responses to these kinds of discourses of truth and accuracy.
That's a can of worms. If people haven't been following Australian politics the last 3 years, we had the same type of government that Britain had, that Trump was in America, and we quietly got rid of it. And now we have a somewhat left-wing government that still cedes to some of the bodies the other government did. We're having very public arguments about whether or not we should. We have these enormous resources, and this government wants to open them up, and the public doesn't. And we proved we vote. We proved we will vote for a single non-party aligned person rather than for a corrupt government. So I don't think we're capable of in the 50s. I don't think we were. We had a left-wing government straight after World War II. It gave us a most amazing setup for a very stable society. And once we had that setup, we voted the right in to keep it. I don't know why we do these things, but whenever we feel safe, we invite the right in, and wait for them to mess it up, then vote the left in to sort things out. It's a pattern. So none of the stuff currently matches anything that Neville Shute saw. Our politics don't fit the novel at all because we've changed so much. We still are to a small extent, but we were the country of massive inventions, huge science, because we had a really, really good schooling. I'm just thinking some of the things I've had to look it up because I do not remember what we invented. In the 50s, we invented solar hot water, the atomic absorption spectrum photometer, stainless steel braces, wool clothing without a permanent crease. Sorry, that's a funny one. The black box, that was an Australian thing. And plastic spectacle lenses in 1960, which takes us to Neville Shute's death. We invented the ultrasound not very long afterwards. Australia has a, not always, but in the 40s and 50s, a massive capacity for scientific invention. And the other country that has that massive capacity is yours. And that's partly because we got a lot of German scientists, because German Jews came here. It's not only because of that, but there was that definitely played a role. What does that mean for the difference between our politics now and on the beach and the science? Is because we have a different relationship to science now. We have a different relation to climate change than we had then. We were one of the first countries to accept continental drift. We accepted it in the 60s. My mother was teaching it at school in the 60s, and the rest of the world hadn't quite accepted it yet. The politics people don't accept climate change because of their business interests. But Australia has accepted climate change because we had those massive big bushfires just before COVID. And they were, I don't know how they're reported overseas, but we haven't seen anything like them. And we know destructive bushfires. We know the difference between something that's spectacularly bad. Mm-hmm. And I've come from a city that had the first visible fire tornadoes. I am fortunately here because the wind changed direction. This is one of those big things where a whole region of the city burnt down because of fire tornadoes and their equivalent. So we are very adept at observing change. We've got very acculturated to observing change, but we don't do the politics. So I can't really give you an answer.
But I find it interesting that you mentioned the fact that you're good at observing change, because I guess the novel was written at a very critical period from the nuclear perspective too, because that's right in the middle of nuclear testing in Australia too, which is not mentioned at all in the novel. And at the time, it was still very much hushed, obviously. I'm quite sure that Neville Shute was aware of at least some of the aspects of that nuclear testing, being an engineer, being interested. And well, by then there was also, well, I guess you did have the testing on the Montebello Islands beforehand, and then they had moved on to southern Australia, Maralinga. So, yeah, it's quite interesting to see this against the background of the novel, that in the same year that it was written, well, in the same years, actually, that it was written and published and then turned into the movie, in all of these years, there was also some sort of nuclear testing happening in Australia. And that's something that's really not taken up in the novel at all. Rather, it's always that sort of distant threat of other nations using nuclear weapons. So the testing aspect is not actually brought up at all. And I think, Tina, you want to say something about this too.
Yes, I just basically want to support your argument and saying that not only is it not brought up, it's even directly contradicted in the novel.
Yeah,
I'm not sure whether it's Moira or Mary. I definitely think it's a female character who says that nobody in the Southern Hemisphere ever dropped an atomic bomb. And that's just blatantly untrue. I mean, it wasn't in war, but in testing.
It wasn't technically untrue. This is the big thing. We accepted the nuclear tests from Britain, and we knew about them, but were quiet about them. You don't diss your owner, your big brother, your big sister, your mother, your father, whatever you call. I don't know what our status with Britain is really complex, but it was Britain who did the Maralinga stuff.
Oh, that's fair enough. And that,
but it was never Australia. We've only got one nuclear facility on the whole country. Unless that's changed in the last 5 years, I've not looked, but we had Lucas Heights, and Lucas Heights was amazingly controversial. New Zealand went the whole shebang and said, we don't even accept nuclear submarines in the harbour. So New Zealand is beyond reproach. Australia is still pretty nuclear free. Mm-hmm. The thing we're guilty of is we're the major uranium exporter for the world. So we have never dropped bombs on everybody. That's completely correct. But we provide a lot of the material for other people to drop bombs. And that's the tricky bit. And it wasn't until the 80s that we started getting a handle on it and that we took responsibility for our perverse position. In the 50s and 60s, so the 50s is when Schutt was writing, even the people who knew, and more people knew than we talk about, secrets are really hard to keep in Australia, or we didn't have a big population and we talk a lot. But respect is something we do. So there was a silence, and a really scary silence in retrospect, and none of us are happy about it. But we still didn't drop bombs. We let the British drop bombs and actually hurt whole parts of a really important country where people were still living. So there's a whole bunch of negatives in there. But the reason the book was quiet on them was because it was written by, and this is quite critical, Neville Shute was Australian, but he was brought up in very standard Britain. He was very much a collegiate person with all the right background. He would have known about it, and he would not have talked about it in a novel where it could put egg on British faces, because it was be his friends who were in government or senior positions who were the people who were doing it. That's my theory. I have not proven this theory.
Sounds quite convincing, though. I was thinking about him being a British Australian author rather than just a British or just an Australian author. So it's very interesting to see the dynamics playing out, that the topic as such still seems to be quite relevant. Obviously, it is sort of a leading up to the Cold War literature that really takes us up again and again and again. And I guess that's what it's being described as too, as one of those first nuclear apocalyptic novels that really hit the target for many people, apparently, because it was a huge commercial success too, the film, but also the novel.
I think there's an element in it which I've never considered until we had this conversation. In the 50s, Australians called England home, except those who called Scotland home or Wales home or Ireland home. But it was actually England. London was actually home. When you visited the UK, you were going home, even if you had no UK ancestry. That there's actually a book about the New Zealand version of the same thing. When I read it and analysed, I thought, oh, that's us too. And that's why we sent soldiers, World War I, World War II, because we were protecting home. And so Schutt didn't have, there were two things there. First of all, the thing we've already talked about, which is that Schutt would leave British culpability out of that story. But the second is that the reason why the whole population had a sense of the end is here is because Britain was already gone. And you don't need to say that because you're still in shock over it. And he puts that into the story with the Americans. That's a safe way of doing it. But if he had have put it in with someone from England going home and seeing London, that would have been overkill, and that's not what he does with On the Beach.
I think this signals a shift, kind of piggybacking off of what you both have said for kind of our last little juncture of discussion, since we've already gone kind of over our budgeted time, to just be to talk about the sort of genre categorization of this text, maybe how it's situated and so on, unless Tina has a very important last thing to say.
Well, I was just going to say, Gillian still hasn't told us about her first time reading the novel, and maybe that's a good point to do that.
Yeah,
now,
that unless... might that might actually be much better, because then we can also kind of get that live, you know how it felt to read, I guess, too, in this situation.
So it wasn't a text in high school. A Town Called Alice was the text, the Neville Shute text. He was a great author, but we read A Town Called Alice, and I never understood why, and I always meant to read On the Beach, but no one talked about it much, except my father, because my father was one of these people who liked talking about the difficult things. So I hadn't read it, and I went to Toronto for my master's, because Toronto was a very fine place for medieval studies. And it was winter in Toronto. Winter in Canada is very bleak. It's very cold. It's very snowfall. It's the opposite of Melbourne I grew up in. Melbourne has a very southern England climate. No, it's more Mediterranean, but with a lot of rain. The saying goes, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. So it could be quite hot. It could, but it was never below about -2. So I was stunned when it got to -40. And I worked my way through the university library. I worked through my way through 18th and 19th century texts in that long winter, and then finally got homesick and I saw On the Beach on the shelves. So I borrowed it and I read it, and I had nightmares for 2 weeks, because this was the first time I had lived overseas at all. It was only the second time I'd traveled overseas, because Australia was really a distant island in the 70s. You couldn't even ring people without booking calls for the longest time. We were isolated. And then this is the other bit. I'm the same age as the child, the baby in the novel. So basically I watched myself die. And Neville Shute depicted the Melbourne of my childhood so precisely, because it didn't change much in the few years between when he wrote it and when I was old enough to start experiencing it. He depicted it so precisely that I knew exactly every street. I knew exactly which tram. I knew what the horses looked like, because the milkman used in my childhood had horses. And so basically I watched everything I know disintegrate. And then it was 3 o'clock in the morning in Canada, and I couldn't even go outside because it was too cold. And I thought, okay, this is the end of the world. Probably not the best time to read it.
No, but that sounds like quite a horrifying reading experience. I can't even properly imagine it, but reading like that, it must have almost made On the Beach a horror novel for you then.
This is the thing. Everybody calls it science fiction because it is, or horror, or apocalyptic, because it's all those things. But when I read it, it was a novel filled with home. It is so precise in its depiction of Australia at that time. Not Australia, Melbourne at that time. There are two authors I think of when I think of On the Beach. Not other work by Neville Shute, just On the Beach. I think of Morris West, who wrote no science fiction at all, as far as I know, because he wrote the same genre, and also from the Australian perspective. And he wrote The Devil's Advocate, is his famous. So very papal, religious, Catholic stuff, which is, you read him and you realise how very non-Catholic Neville Shute is. And the other author is John Wyndham, because it's Cozy Catastrophe. And so that's what I always think of On the Beach as, Cozy Catastrophe.
I think there's actually some others who have done that on an academic level as well. So the Cozy Catastrophe, except for the ending, which sort of does negate that idea. But other than that, reading through the novel up until the end, that's quite fitting.
What I find really striking is that, well, you said it is science fiction. Yes, it is. But it's also not very, it's not futuristic at all from our perspective. It's, you know, set in the 60s, I think.
63, I think.
Yeah, so not futuristic at all from our point of view, but it's not really all that futuristic from the point of view of Rising either, because it's just reality, just a few millimeters to the left, because something catastrophic has happened. So I think that makes it a really interesting text genre-wise, because it's really hard to grasp what it is. It is science fiction. It is apocalyptic, as you said, it's cozy catastrophe. There's dystopian elements, because we have the destruction of society through this nuclear war. And I think that makes it a really interesting text in that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, I think Gillian has already pointed this out at a few points, how the author is actually quite playful with some of the elements of society, but also of genre that he's looking at. If you look at the science aspect of science fiction, he takes very seriously some of the descriptions, I think, especially from an engineering perspective, which obviously makes sense for him as an engineer. At the same time, there has been quite a bit of criticism because he's not very accurate. And I think we had accuracy beforehand as a topic. He's not very accurate when it comes to the actual process of radioactivity spreading across the world and fallout. Well, his depiction has been debunked. And even in, I think, like in the early 60s and 70s again. So people have been focusing on that because it was such a tremendous success. And people really liked, I think, the apocalyptic narrative that was in there. But they also took this for granted as being basically reality, just very short around the corner. So it's what is going to happen to everybody, which it wouldn't have been. At least according to the studies that I read.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I read a similar study that was from 1974. That was like a physics study that started with Neville Shute as, the sort of hook for the article. And it was like, oh, Neville Shute and On the Beach said that if a nuclear war happens, the fallout will kill all of humanity. But is that actually true? And it goes through all these calculations, the scientific discourse, and comes to the conclusion, well, no, it's not true. Not everybody's going to die from nuclear war. And I thought it was an interesting take. It's like, well, this is not so bad. They did make a point of writing in the conclusion that this is not to say that we approve of nuclear war. Like, this is still terrible. It's just that not the entirety of humanity is going to die.
I went for the research, it was way early. It was in the 70s because I was curious. So I hadn't read the book at that point, but I wanted to know whether I live, Melbourne. And the thing was, in the 50s, they didn't know. So Shute chose one of the possible outcomes at a point when science was still unclear. Having said that, if you read In the Wet, which is his actual science fiction novel, it's more fantasy with the science than it is science fiction. In other words, he does fudge. He's not a science fiction writer with... He's not a hard science fiction writer. He's a soft science fiction writer with added fantasy. And he's actually much more a realistic writer.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to delve into that question. As you said, well, they didn't know in the 50s, so it is not like a deliberate exaggeration of what is going to happen. But we could ask the question, is that justified to have this worst case scenario in order to, I don't know, maybe inspire people, well, to be more careful, not to do that. Follow Dwight's example, because that's also an interesting twist in the story. We learn at the end that even though Dwight is captaining a nuclear submarine, he never shot his bombs. So he's innocent. Even though lots of people are blaming him, he's American, oh, you did that, and you came here with a nuclear submarine. And that's something that I had to think about also when you said that nuclear submarines aren't allowed in havens in New Zealand. And we have him here, we have him coming to Australia, but he's innocent. He's never done this thing. He's not participated in the nuclear war in shooting his bombs. So
I think that was a political statement myself, because of when it was published. This was before the Bay of Pigs. This was when the Cold War was probably the scariest moment. So giving people the capacity to say, I do not have to do this thing, is a powerful permission. So Neville Shute was a social activist. Every single thing he wrote is evidence of that. In the Wet is my favorite because it's so bizarre in the way it demonstrates that. but it's still very much social activism. And so I can't say this without having more research into it, but my reading of it is that he was making a point about, look, we could all die. You do not have to fight this war. We can get through this. And he wasn't the only one, and we did get through that period. Whether we got through this one, who knows? But we got through that. So it was, he was part of a really big discourse and had a surprising influence in Australia. And the fact that we're talking now means that it reached outside Australia. So maybe he chose those things on purpose. Maybe they were just part of his outlook.
To some extent, Shoot is definitely visionary in the sense that he notes that there are people who will not push the button, right? You know, so much of mutually assured destruction is about the, you know, pushing the button, saying goodbye. But we have examples like Stanislav Petrov in the 80s who, you know, didn't press the button when there was this false nuclear alarm. And, you know, that averted probable catastrophe. So I think even just that representation is really, really important on the level of recognizing that humans have empathy, even in this, you know, Cold War that's just kind of at its beginning, the time of the novel.
And I've just, you saying Petrov made me think of something that's rather important, which I've completely forgotten. Vladimir Petrov, the Petrov affair, was 1954 in Australia. It was our big moment of realization about what the Cold War meant, because we were the other end of the world and bombs back then didn't reach this far. We were safe. But the Petrov affair meant we learnt we weren't safe politically. We were capable of being of interest to the Soviets. And that was 1954. So then this may be We Are Not Safe book came from Australian politics in the 50s.
Yeah, and I guess what's interesting about the novel is that Neville Shute is not really anti-nuclear because he does have the submarine and that's never questioned. But he's warning people of individual actions and what impact then can have. So it's the individual pushing the button. It's not people using nuclear energy or other aspects of that to do politics, but also to, economic aspects. So I find it quite interesting that he makes a distinction that, well, he doesn't make a distinction really. So he's focusing on human actions rather than on any material or other aspects of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just an observation there. And just to add to the conversation earlier, I think so, Gillian, it's interesting that you say that in the 50s nobody would have been aware of how it could actually go if these things happened, because the one of the earliest articles that I found on this, trying to debunk, it's actually an editorial, was from 1960. So it must have been related. Well, I think it actually mentions the movie and sort of the scientist being very exhausted from having to explain to people again and again that this is actually not how it's going to happen. And so you can really read this frustration in that editorial, and it's not very long. He says, well, basically you could just take two easy steps and you wouldn't die, but at the same time, yes, I think that, so it might have actually sparked some conversations too and created that interest in actually looking at the consequences in a bit more detail at the time.
I know it did here. I know that the wind patterns, the role of the equator and the wind patterns between the hemispheres start to be seriously studied after that.
Oh, wow. So. Yeah. Well, and I guess it's also interesting that you can see how much the novel still resonates with us today. There's still being articles written about it each year. I think that I found one from 21 and 22. So there's still people who find something in the novel that they feel that hasn't been discussed yet, or that we can relate to our current situation. Which is something that is probably very admirable, that the novel can still strike so many chords at this time.
Yeah, there's a book coming out this year that talks about apocalypses, both nuclear and climate related ones. And that takes On the Beach into account, as well as some climate catastrophe novels. So I think there's also something there in this connection where we have this feeling of the end time. And just when you were describing the frustration of the writer of this editorial, that must be something that climate scientists are feeling at the moment as well. It's like, we are telling you what to do so not to die, but you're not doing it. It's slightly different because, you know, different context. And here it's because the fallout is not going to be as deadly as described in the novel. So it's not quite the same situation, but I think the frustration is probably similar.
I mean, I would even take it a step further and say, you know, that the, you know, the nuclear potential for conflict is as strong as it has been in the past. You know, in response to the Russian-Ukrainian war, it's been talked about heavily by political and social commentators. I remember when Tina and I last July went to Finland, they sent us email about the possibility of nuclear warfare and Helsinki being a target and things like this. Our university sent out things talking about power outages and what to do in the case of these kinds of situations. And it's like, it's a threat that's very serious and it's still present, even if it's not as present in our minds as other catastrophes and crises that we face.
It so definitely I think
there's,
is.
There's also that adding kind of a persistent relevance is the fact that that actual nuclear anxiety is not finished, right? Once the bomb was created, that initiated this kind of anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually taught a course on anti-nuclear literature in the last winter semester. So very recently. Mm-hmm. And what the students really said is that they're so much more aware of many of these topics now. Well, because Fukushima and all other catastrophes or potential threats seemed so far away for them because this was when they were really children still. So they really didn't take this up as much, but this was a new situation for them to become aware of the dangers and the threat and the related anxieties surrounding nuclear power and weapons.
The thing is that the rest of the world has more nuclear capacity than Australia. We are still not that country. I suspect the reason why On the Beach has become the go-to book internationally is because Australia is Western enough so people can say, oh, look, it's like us, but it's not any of you. So it's safe to read us dying.
I will say that's not the feeling that my students had. They didn't feel it was safe because when I talked about it in class, it was, I think, literally the week after Putin pulled out of the nuclear agreements. And so I came into class and said, okay, we're going to discuss On the Beach now. And I didn't expect it to be quite so topical. And they were chilled. It was definitely a horrifying experience for them as well. And they were very impressed by the novel because of that as well.
So maybe I'm doing the Australian thing and saying Australian things aren't important. And maybe it's that classic novel which just happens to be science fiction.
I think it can be both. I mean, there is also academic discourse about the shield of distance that lies over Australia. And that can certainly work in both directions in that we can set the apocalypse there. It's going to be distanced enough from so-called mainstream readers. But at the same time, it's also it's the last country that will be affected by this thing because it's shielded by its distance. Actually, I saw a movie a while ago that was about a meteor impact. And that was also set in Australia because the global fire wall was going to come to Australia at the very last moment. I'm not sure this is scientifically accurate either, because A, it depends on where the impact is going to be, and B, it's going to be like in rings. So this
technically
is...
you're talking about the most southerly point of the world that has a city. You want Patagonia, the very southern tip of the Americas. So all these novels should be set there. But Australia is English speaking, and the main language of the science fictional world and the catastrophe novel is English speaking. I do not know why we are these people, but we are. And so the language pushes it to Australia. Mm. Whereas if you were being the genuine very south, Patagonia would be a really interesting place to set something. Whereas Melbourne, to be honest, my childhood was wonderful. It was very peaceful. It was very pedestrian. Melbourne is a very... in the 60s was a wonderful, safe place to live. Unless you're in a certain area that had crime bosses, but we didn't go there.
Unless nuclear war happens.
If nuclear war happens, I would have been dead at age 1.5.
Any other final thoughts to close out this podcast episode?
Well, I just guess it this all takes us back to the title and On the Beach, or the beaches as this liminal space. Because I think that's what the novel does in many ways. It does bring some connections, and it does sort of destroy that idea of that shield surrounding Australia, because it doesn't save Australia. It's not a barrier anymore. It's something that can be overcome by that radioactivity. So, yeah, That's very unrefined, but I guess, yeah.
The beach is not liminal here. The beach is where we all live. Most of Australian, okay, I don't live in the beach. I live in the national capital, which is the only major inland city. Mm-hmm. All other of our major cities are on the beach. So from an Australian perspective, on the beach refers to where people live. But it's where people live. We always live the middle.
Yeah, and where they usually have very pleasurable experiences. It's not really, yeah, it's not negative at all.
Exactly.
Your beach is safer than our beach. Queensland, we have crocodiles and all sorts of deadly things in our beaches. So we're taught, and we have riptides, and I've got a friend who died from one of them just a few years ago. So beaches are not safe places, but they are home. They're part of the way we live. Children who don't swim in Australia are regarded as strange and atypical. People who can't deal with who don't know how to be safe at the beach. Actually, this is kind of maybe what he's saying, I don't know. But we're taught how to behave on the beach. It's part of our everyday etiquette. Where you can swim, there are flags to swim between. Who to watch out if there are lifesavers. How to signal if you're in trouble. What animals, what creatures in the waters you have to absolutely avoid because they will kill you. And how to spot a shark. We were taught how to spot sharks. Sharks only kill one person a year, or one person every 3 years. I'm not sure anymore. But we're still taught how to spot them. So the Jaws didn't have nearly the same impact in Australia as it had in America, because the whole of Australia, we're cautious about things. We have the spiders and the snakes and things, and we have very hot heat that you need to have lots of water, which is what I didn't do today. So in a way, Australian life is liminal in theory, and a lot of Americans won't visit here because we're not safe. But in practice, we're used to that. It's part of every day. And if you think about it, that's what Shute did with the novel, isn't it? He made the liminality of the end of the world part of the everyday.
Oh, completely. And what you just said also just highlights how lucky we are to have you on this podcast, because I think we got so many interesting insights that we would never have got without you present here. So I think I just want to thank you for doing this podcast with us, because I think it has been a really exciting conversation.
Yeah, and that was the perfect wrap up.
I've loved listening to all of you talk about on the beach, because I've never seen it from an outsider perspective. I have learned so much. So thank you.
This has been one of our podcast episodes. We welcome and encourage you to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or on our YouTube channel, or indeed all of the above. We would also be very happy if you could review us on your podcast service if you can. You can find all these details in the description. If you're interested in being a guest on our podcast, just drop us an email. And don't forget, stay speculative.